Joining me today on the phone from Hamilton, Ontario, is Dr. Ruth A. Frager, Associate Professor in the Department of History at McMaster University and co-author of the new book, Discounted Labor, Women Workers in Canada, 1870 to 1939. Welcome to the program, Ruth.
Well, thank you.
Ruth Frager, can you tell me why you chose the dates 1870 to 1939 for the scope of your study?
Well, partly we wanted to capture a relatively early phase of industrialization, when industrialization is really gaining momentum, in the late 1800s, and follow that through into the early 1900s. A kind of point of 1939 is really a question of when the Second World War comes in, and things do change in the aftermath, during the war itself, and then they change in the aftermath of the war. So it seemed like a very good period to be looking at the late 1800s and relatively early 1900s.
And can you tell us what kind of jobs women were doing at the time?
Yes, by and large, there's a very sharp gender division of labor, so that there are so many jobs that are seen as only men's jobs. And what we've been trying to do in the book is to try to talk about the way in which certain jobs were coded as women's jobs. And these tended to be relatively low-wage jobs, jobs that were seen as less skilled. And so we're looking at the way in which women were restricted to female job ghettos. And part of what's so interesting about this period is that if you look at where the women tended to be working, for those women who did go out to work at the turn of the century, and you look at where women who are out in the workforce today are concentrating, there are some very striking parallels, quite a number of parallels.
And what were some of the dominant discourses surrounding women's work that would confine them to specific tasks?
Well, part of it is the strength of the domestic ideology, the idea that the woman really belongs at home. And it's rather ironic because the domestic ideology, while seeming to support this idea that women have this special role to play in society and that they belong in the home and should be protected, ironically, it means that for those women who did go out to work, especially those who were poor and needed to obtain an income, they're treated pretty badly, partly because the rationale is, well, they don't really need the money, even though they really do, but the rationale is, well, they should be supported by a father or a husband if they have one. So the idea is they don't really need these jobs. This is a common perception in this period, common misperception. And also that they're only doing this temporarily, until perhaps their unemployed husband gets a new job, or they're only doing this temporarily until they get married. So the rationale is that better jobs should be reserved for men because they're automatically seen as the rightful breadwinners for families. And so this means that the domestic ideology provides a rationale for confining women to poorer jobs and reserving so many jobs for men.
In what ways did unions address this notion of the family wage?
Well, what we have is a situation where there's a combination of motives. There were certainly male unionists who felt that women should not go out to work, that women shouldn't have to work in the kinds of factory conditions that were really quite terrible at the turn of the century. And so part of the idea was that, from their point of view, the ideal would be for the male breadwinner, the male head of the family, to be earning enough so that neither his wife nor his teenage children, or even somewhat younger children, would have to go out to work to supplement family income. So the idea is that given how difficult many of these jobs were in this period, you can see the logic of saying that women should stay at home, men should be earning what they call the family wage. But at the same time, it's also clearly a way of restricting women's access to income. It's partly a way of trying to ensure that the male head of the family would be maintained in that position as dominant within the family.
And how have property rights served to disadvantage women workers?
Well, in the very early phase, before industrialization in Canada, especially if we stick with English Canada for the moment, we're looking at a situation where married women virtually had no property rights. So even if, which is rare, if a woman's father had died and left her some property, the minute she marries, that property belongs to her husband. And if they're working together on a family farm and she puts in all this work as he does on the farm, nonetheless, everything on that farm belongs to him, even the frying pan and whatever other basic kitchen utensils they may have that are more associated with a woman's role. We start to see some campaigns to bring in property rights for married women, and there are some changes in the early 1800s and more changes by the time we're in the late 1800s. So that in itself is sort of also important in terms of limiting women's access to to property, clearly, and to funds in that way.
And what would be the situation for French Canada?
In French Canada, it's a bit different because of the French traditions. There's more a sense of common property in the marriage. So if they're working on a family farm and they're French Canadians in Quebec, the sense is that the property is the family property. The woman has an interest in it, as does the man. But the sense of, I wouldn't call that a sense of equality. He's certainly the one who's in control of that joint property. But she's entitled to more of that if he dies. And so it puts women in less of a submissive position, but only somewhat less. And this is sort of going back to the pre-industrial period, and we do start to see changes as we move through the 1800s.
Could you speak to women's work in the context of immigration?
Immigration to Canada?
Yes.
Yes. Part of what we're trying to do in the book is to look at the intersection of a number of different hierarchies. So in addition to gender dynamics, we're trying to look at the way in which that intersects with such things as class dynamics and also especially issues of racism. And part of what we're trying to stress is that, you know, we can look at women and see which jobs were coded as women's jobs in this period and how so many jobs were reserved for men. But when we look at quote-unquote women's jobs, we also have to keep in mind the way in which so many of these so-called women's jobs were clearly off-limits to women from particular kinds of backgrounds. The situation for African-Canadian women is particularly extreme. You know, these are women coming from very poor groups, and because of the discrimination that they, as well as their menfolk, faced, it's so important for them to be able to earn an income. But in fact, what's happening is they're basically being restricted to domestic labor. The idea of the maid is what we would now call her. She might be a live-in maid, she might be doing it on a basis of day work and living in her own home. But this was so often one of the very few things that African-Canadian women could do when they needed to work. And, you know, there's so many disadvantages to that kind of job. There are other groups that we can talk about as well. Immigrant Jewish women from Eastern Europe, for example, often found jobs in the clothing industry, and part of the reason is that Jews would not be hired for so many other kinds of factory work. And when we look at white-collar jobs, which are particularly interesting, and they're growing, especially as we turn the corner into the early 1900s, the sector is growing in importance in the economy in general, and especially in terms of women's work. But for many of those jobs, immigrant women would not be hired. Clearly, there are language problems, but even if a woman from whose family was from Eastern Europe or Southern Europe, if she herself were born in Canada, if she herself had a good command of English and had been fortunate enough to receive a high school education, even so, if she looked, you know, quote-unquote, too foreign, if she had a allegedly foreign-sounding name, there are so many jobs that she simply would not even be considered for. And this includes not only jobs in offices that had more status than factory work, but it also includes other kinds of jobs as well. in the large retail stores, for example, in the department stores, such as Eaton's, the sales force was seen as, the idea was that immigrant women would not be seen as appropriate for the sales force. So we're talking about immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. We're also talking about other kinds of immigrants. So immigrant Chinese women would never be considered for sales work in a department store in this period.
Were there any instances where feminist resistance would transcend these racial boundaries?
Well, it's an excellent question, and we've been looking for these kinds of things. Trying to look at especially class boundaries as well, and to what extent women from somewhat more privileged backgrounds, middle class Anglo-Protestant women in particular, to what extent they may have tried to reach out to and help women from less fortunate backgrounds. And the situation is that it's very limited. We do have some of these middle class women as social reformers who did try to help bring in certain kinds of legislation, to bring in more factory inspection, for example, to bring in minimum wages for women workers, for example. And these are important, but given the intensity of the problems that so many women experience when they went out to work, these kinds of initiatives seem in some ways very limited, and they're also limited in terms of any potential gains, partly because the enforcement of any laws that were enacted in these areas, the enforcement was really quite poor. When we're looking for cross-class alliances of women, alliances that might cross ethnic barriers and barriers having to do with notions of race, there's some, but it's really very, very limited. And we also see overt racism in certain cases. One of the issues, for example, is what has been called the white women's labor law. And women's groups, especially middle-class women's groups, were promoting this at the turn of the century, especially the late 1800s. The idea was that it was allegedly dangerous for women who are deemed white to be working for immigrant Chinese men who sometimes had small laundries, commercial laundries, sometimes had small restaurants. And so you see a number of different groups, and in particular middle-class women's groups, such as the National Council of Women of Canada, trying to bring in laws that would prohibit white women, as they're deemed, from working in these kinds of positions for immigrant male Chinese owners. And, you know, I mean, it's clearly very racist in terms of the attitudes toward these men. The idea is that they're stereotyped as lecherous, as deceptive, as, you know, a terrible moral problem. And if working class women don't know enough, working class white women, you know, the idea is that if they don't know enough, quote unquote, to protect themselves by not even taking these jobs, then middle class women's groups, allied with a number of other groups, will step in and push for a law that will make it illegal for these women to be employed by these men. So, you know, there are cases where you see overt racism kicking in quite clearly.
Besides legislation, what other kinds of resistance was there?
Well, what we've tried to look at in particular is what's going on in terms of the women in various occupations themselves. We've looked at women factory workers especially to see what's going on in terms of the trade union movement, although we also have to keep in mind that the labor movement's fairly weak in this period. Sometimes we do see militancy on the shop floor on the part of women workers. Sometimes they're turning to unions. Sometimes they're going out on strike to try to deal with especially low pay, especially harsh working conditions, and very long hours. Sometimes they're taking these steps on their own. Sometimes they're taking these steps along with male co-workers. And if we look at the attitudes of the trade union movement in this period, again, we see a mix. Male union leaders were sometimes sympathetic to female workers, and sometimes we see real solidarity between men and women. There are times, though, when male union leaders, especially in the more skilled craft unions, very much saw women workers as a threat to their own jobs and their own status as especially skilled workers. And so sometimes what we see is male workers trying to use their unions to police the boundaries of the gender division of labor and to try to keep women out of their workplaces and out of what these men saw as their own jobs.
What do you think the main lessons are that can be learned from these experiences, especially for pay equity advocates?
It's a hard question. We certainly have seen more in the last 60 or so years. I mean, in the aftermath of the Second World War, we have seen more going on in terms of human rights initiatives. By the time we're in the 1960s, we see the resurgence of the women's rights movement. And in some ways, the picture that we see in more recent times does have to do with more more demand for pay equity laws and the enforcement of those laws, more laws against discrimination in employment that would pertain to sex discrimination as well as racist discrimination. We've also seen unions becoming more responsive to women workers' interests, especially because the public sector unions have become so important. I think that a lot of the changes that we have seen, and certainly we can talk about the changes we haven't seen, but in terms of changes that we have seen, a lot of this has come from grassroots organization and people mobilizing for these kinds of goals, and I think that's quite important. At the same time, in many ways, so many women who go out to work in this day and age remain confined to the kinds of female job ghettos that we see 100 years earlier. And, you know, it's a very difficult situation, and I think there needs to be a lot more mobilization around these kinds of issues.
Hence the importance of labor history, I guess, in informing the present.
And the importance of the labor movement, the importance of the women's rights movement, and the importance of forming coalitions amongst women and men, clearly coalitions in terms of anti-racist coalitions that can link up with parts of the labor movement, that can link up with women's rights initiatives and so forth.
One last question about changes we haven't seen. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit?
Well, I mean, certainly we have seen women moving into certain kinds of occupations that were much more limited to them. You know, there are many, many more women doctors now. There are certainly more women professors. You know, there are quite a number of sectors we can point to. But still, these gains are limited, and there are so many women who are still in these very traditional female job ghettos. The gap between the income of the average full-time year-round woman who goes out to work and the average full-time year-round male who goes out to work in Canada, that gap is still significant. In 2002, the exact figure was 71%, so she would earn roughly 71% of what he earns. You know, there are a number of different ways of trying to explain why that gap is still with us. But one issue is clearly discrimination and the devaluation of women's work. And that's something that we've seen the women's movement mobilizing around, not only in more recent decades, but even back in this earlier period. What we've been trying to do in the book is track this with regard to women teachers, for example, who are some of the strongest people who are speaking out for equal pay for women, for the same work as men. But, you know, so much more work needs to be done in this area in our day and age as well.
How do you feel about bringing back the notion of the family wage for single parents in Canada?
Well, part of the issue that we face is that with single parenthood increasing, the family wage in some ways, as it's been traditionally conceived, becomes less and less relevant. You know, the idea that the typical family would have a woman who's at home while the male is the head of the family, that he would be earning quote-unquote, ideally the family wage to support his kids and his wife, you know, that's so much less applicable now, now that there are so many more single women heading families, you know, whether single, whether through divorce, widowhood, or perhaps never marrying. And so this alleged ideal has less and less application to what's going on. It's very rare now for these, the family that's still thought of as typical is still fairly, is rare in this day and age. And so, you know, the issue of incomes for women is especially important now, as indeed it was then.
Well, I was thinking about reclaiming this notion of the family wage and using it as a tool to promote livelihoods, a living wage.
Oh, the idea of a living wage.
A living wage, yeah, I guess, for single parents.
The adults in the family, or the adult if it's a single parent family, should be earning a living wage for that family, and I think that's quite important.
Great. Would you have any last words to share with listeners out there about your book called Discounted Labor, Women Workers in Canada, 1870 to 1939?
Well, I hope that people will find it interesting, since, you know, we think it's such an interesting historical period. And I also hope that it will help people understand more about the underlying forces that I think account for some of the reasons that women are still in female drug ghettos today.
Great. Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Ruth A. Frager.
Thanks very much for your interest. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Ruth A. Frager, Associate Professor in the Department of History at McMaster University and co-author with Carmela Patrias of the new book, Discounted Labor, Women Workers in Canada, 1870 to 1939, out now on University of Toronto Press. I'm Candace Moores for the CKDU Women's Collective.